Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, days after Special Counsel Robert Mueller's appointment, he was drawn into a heated dispute between Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and then Acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe over who would ultimately oversee the investigation. McCabe argued that Rosenstein's memo justifying the firing of former FBI Director James Comey implicated him in a potential obstruction of justice case against President Trump. McCabe lost that fight and was later fired. A Bloomberg story about Chinese efforts to clandestinely install spy chips in U.S. computers appears to be fake news. Meanwhile, a senior Chinese intelligence official was arrested in a sting operation and extradited yesterday to the United States to face espionage charges. Yan Junzhu, a deputy division director in the Ministry of State Security, is the first Chinese intelligence officer ever to be extradited to face trial in open court. He's accused of trying to procure intelligence related to the design of jet engine fan blades. Then the U.S. military has grounded its entire fleet of F-35 fighter jets in the wake of a crash last month in South Carolina. The F-35 has been dogged by cost overruns, poor performance, and engineering problems virtually since its inception. And then U.S. intelligence services apparently have intercepts of Saudi government communications indicating that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the kidnapping of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who has been missing for more than a week since entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Turkish officials believe that Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered inside the consulate. The Saudis are denying any wrongdoing. And finally, federal court judges are balking at what they call unlawful efforts by U.S. immigration authorities to continue to detain people charged with entering the country unlawfully, even after they have been granted bail. The rulings complicate the Trump administration's so-called zero-tolerance policy against defendants charged with crossing the border illegally. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Washington. Days after Special Counsel Robert Mueller's appointment, he was drawn into a heated dispute between Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and then Acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe over who would ultimately oversee the investigation. McCabe argued that Rosenstein's memo justifying the firing of former FBI Director James Comey implicated him in a potential obstruction of justice case against President Trump. McCabe lost that fight and eventually was fired. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, when I first saw this on CNN, I thought it was an interesting inside the beltway little kerfuffle. And then I realized once I read it that it's actually quite a bit more important than that. What we have here is McCabe, who, like I said, lost the fight, making a valid point that Rosenstein ought to have recused himself because it was Rosenstein that wrote the memo agreeing with President Trump's argument that he had the authority and the reason, the cause, to fire James Comey as FBI director. So if there was an obstruction of justice case to be made against the president, wouldn't that obstruction of justice case also then have implicated Rosenstein?
It might have, I guess. Sure, that's a reasonable assumption. But the question is the whole thing was a ball of confusion, and the whole question of obstruction of justice by a sitting president was itself a very confusing matter. So I think the DOJ and the FBI were sort of tying themselves up in knots over how to proceed with this thing. And I think this kerfluffle between McCabe and Rosenstein sort of is indicative of that deep institutional confusion. So I think there was layer upon layer of confusion as to what all this meant, how to proceed, et cetera. I mean, you had the FBI, the DOJ, appointing a special counsel to investigate the president, their boss, of obstructing their own work, essentially. And so it was really terra incognita, and they were very confused how to proceed, and they therefore both, you know, were at each other's throats as to who was more qualified or who was untainted.
Let's try to, John, untangle this, because
Now we have McCabe, who was then acting director of the FBI after Comey's fired by Trump, arguing that Rosenstein should not handle the investigation. He shouldn't oversee the Mueller probe because he had worked with Trump to fire Comey.
Right.
Okay, that's step number one. Now, step number two, McCabe, after that, according to memos that have now been released, wrote that Rosenstein had also suggested in that meeting to muster support among cabinet members of the Trump cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office. Rosenstein's defenders say that's not true. Mm-hmm. Now, this is why we thought 2 weeks ago for sure that Donald Trump was about to fire Rod Rosenstein when these memos from McCabe came out. Now, McCabe has a score to settle with Rosenstein and, of course, with Trump as well, because he was fired. Also, McCabe was the person who was overseeing the FBI's investigation of the Hillary Clinton email server, mm-hmm. whereby she did State Department work on her own private server. That was a major issue in the 2016 campaign. One part, John and Daniel, of Rosenstein's argument about why McCabe should not be as in charge of the Mueller probe was that McCabe had worn a T-shirt supporting his wife's political campaign for the state Senate in Virginia, and he could not be considered objective in the political probe. A photo of McCabe, this is according to the Washington Post, wearing the shirt had been posted on social media during the campaign. Now, McCabe's wife, Daniel, received more than $500,000 from Hillary Clinton's close pal, Terry McAuliffe, who was then, I believe, governor or former governor of Virginia. So McCabe's wife is working with the Democrats, working with Hillary Clinton. He's in charge of the probe of Hillary Clinton's email servers. He's wearing a T-shirt in support of his wife's political campaign, supported by the Clintons. Rosenstein comes back to him and says, wait, I don't have a conflict of interest. You have a conflict of interest.
That's right.
I mean, I think that's kind of how this played out.
Yeah, that seems to me to be what it is. You know, besides the argument that a sitting president can't be charged with a criminal act, that if a president commits a criminal act, he has to be charged in the House of Representatives rather than in a court. The House of Representatives then calls impeachment hearings. If the impeachment vote is carried out and positive, the president then goes to the U.S. Senate for trial. So there are several different issues at play here. And, you know, it's as though the 1970s never happened. We should know, at least in the Justice Department, we should know how you remove a sitting president. And here you've got some of the topmost officials in justice that are confused and fighting with each other because they're not sure what happens in a situation like this.
And I think, Daniel, if I'm not wrong about this, Rosenstein is basically saying, making the argument, I didn't say invoke the 25th Amendment. McCabe is making that up to throw a shade over me in Donald Trump's eyes and to lead to my firing. Obviously, based on the recent comments, Donald Trump isn't going to fire Rosenstein. Perhaps he believes him. Anyway, what do you think about that?
It makes perfect sense. I think that Rosenstein's job seems secure for the moment. Trump doesn't want to can him 4 weeks before the midterm elections. He wants to keep this quiet and doesn't want to do anything provocative that'll give Democrats anything to hang on to.
This probe from Mueller has gone on and on and on. There are indictments. They always talk about scores of indictments, but there's no, as of right now, I don't see one real solid connection between Russia or the Russian government and collusion with the Trump administration. Well, we're waiting. I mean, if it comes out, fine.
Aside from calling it the Russia investigation, you don't even hear the word Russia anymore because there is no connection.
I persist in believing that there was no Russian collusion. The idea is illogical. It was preposterous in the quote that former the Russian oligarch, Deripaska, if that's his name. And I don't believe there's any collusion there. And I think that in that respect that Mueller's investigation will come up dry. But this also involved the question of obstruction, of presidential obstruction of justice. And I think that is also fairly implausible. I mean, I think that that Trump was not obstructing justice when he asked Comey
to go easy on his national security advisor.
Michael Flynn.
And that seems to be the essence of the, that seems to be the chief concern, that somehow was stepping out of line, that somehow was an obstruction of an official investigation. But I don't think it really was. I think the president has a great latitude in directing these investigations. So I think that the obstruction investigation will really go nowhere. And I think the Russia investigation will really go nowhere. I could be wrong. Mueller may pull a rabbit out of his hat tomorrow and I'll look foolish. But I really am very skeptical about both avenues of inquiry.
Yeah, I agree with Daniel, John. I think if there's evidence, if it comes out, we will discuss the evidence. But so far, the convictions are for perjury.
Yes, which we predicted, by the way.
Yeah, money laundering, in the case of Manafort, tax evasion. Mm-hmm. And now, Daniel, we did a story a couple of days ago. Rick Gates, also indicted, who is Paul Manafort's aide, he was trying to work with the Israeli or with Israeli companies to really basically take over a very sophisticated Facebook operation for the Trump campaign. Now, you would think you could make the argument, hey, there is collusion. It's an Israeli company, maybe ties to the Israeli government. But it doesn't seem to me, Daniel, that the Clinton campaign or the Democrats are making too much about that possible allegation of collusion between Israel and the Trump campaign.
Of course not, for obvious political reasons. I mean, everyone's very happy to jump on Russia, and no one wants to jump on Israel, which is kind of a sacred territory as far as both the Republicans and Democrats are concerned. So Israel is allowed to interfere in U.S. elections. That's kind of prime. It's kind of normal. But if Russia, buys a few Facebook ads, assuming they even did, that brings the roof down.
That's the scandal. Well, we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and the author of three great books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Bloomberg story about Chinese efforts to clandestinely install spy chips in U.S. computer servers appears to be fake news. Meanwhile, a senior Chinese intelligence official was arrested in a sting operation and extradited yesterday to the United States to face espionage charges. Yan Junzhu, a deputy division director in the Ministry of State Security, is the first Chinese intelligence officer ever to be extradited to face trial in open court. He's accused of trying to procure intelligence related to the design of jet engine fan blades. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, always good to have you.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be on.
Chris, walk us through this Bloomberg story. It was a pretty hard-hitting story, lots of anonymous sources. It made some bold accusations, and every company and every government involved in the story has denied that any of it is true.
And I want to read the headline to show people how alarming it sounds, because you can't have believed this story and not come to the conclusion the U.S. supply chain for technology is compromised unless the U.S. breaks all relations with Chinese suppliers.
That's it.
Which maybe was the point of the story. The headline is "The Big Hack: How China Used a Tiny Chip to Infiltrate U.S. Companies." Subhead: "The attack by Chinese spies reached almost 30 U.S. companies, including Amazon and Apple, by compromising America's technology supply chain, according to extensive interviews with government and corporate sources." But Chris, Apple says not true. Amazon says not true. Now the Department of Homeland Security Cybersecurity Center says not true. The government of the UK says not true. Is it not true?
I don't believe it's true. No. There have been, since this story came out last week, there have been so many questions raised about it. And many people, including some who talked to Bloomberg about the story, have come out and actually said that there are issues with the way it was covered. In particular, the quoted security expert Joe Fitzpatrick, who from the piece, went on the Risky Biz podcast a couple days ago to explain how he believes he was misquoted, and he explained how in theory this could happen, and it seems that Bloomberg took his information and made it look like that is exactly how it happened. He was giving them theoretical background, and they basically took that, and it looks like they ran with, that's how it happened. There are so many issues with this story, and it really took the InfoSec world by surprise last week, and many of us spent many days over the weekend and this week looking into it and trying to understand the logic behind it. I want to say, if a foreign government, if the U.S. government wanted to attack the supply chain like this, there are much easier ways and much less intrusive ways to do it, rather than putting this chip on how many thousands of servers. There are many other smarter, effectively ways that they could have done this. That said, there are still many, many questions left to be answered, including why Bloomberg went ahead with this when there are so many things unknown.
I mean, a hack would involve software, right? If you have...
Yeah, that's a hack.
That's a hack.
Mm-hmm.
But what this report is saying, and it says it categorically based on extensive interviews, when you have to really read the article carefully in Bloomberg. The first time I read it, it sounded convincing. Then I read it again, and I read it a third time. And it's based on anonymous sources. The probe that uncovered this terrible act by the Chinese... it turns out that it was a private third-party investigative unit. Then it doesn't reveal the name of the third-party investigative unit. It's a very cleverly written article. And now, as I mentioned, even though they quote Amazon and said that Amazon Web Services sent this new acquisition to a third party to do an investigative probe, Amazon says we didn't do any such thing. I think, though, Chris, that the net effect of this is to make it hard for Americans or American businesses to trust Chinese businesses. And moreover, the Chinese companies that were named, their stocks plummeted.
Oh, yes.
They went down
There's a real impact.
Real.
When you make statements like this.
This almost bankrupted these companies. And then you could say a week or two later, oh, actually, not the story. Nonetheless, they've lost billions of dollars of wealth, Chinese companies. Some of them may not recover.
Yeah, Supermicro just took a huge, huge hit as a result of this. It's been, in some ways, it seems like it could be a hit for whatever reason on Supermicro. Politically, I think there are a number of reasons, and we can talk about it, why, it would be convenient for this story against China to be coming out right now with all the rhetoric we're seeing about trade and tariffs. I want to just quote or bring to attention Robert M. Lee, who actually ran the detection of this type of thing, the department that would detect these kind of things at the NSA at the time that this was happening, put on Twitter, I led the ICS discovery threat. ICS is just industrial control systems. I led the ICS threat discovery mission at the time at the NSA, and I had never heard of this attack being a cyber attack. The NSA doesn't see everything, but if the U.S. intelligence community is your source, we would have. Now, what reason would he have to come out and say that? He could have just stayed quiet and not said anything. So we have, like you said earlier, the U.S. government, the U.K. government, the former head of threat discovery at the NSA at the time, Apple, Amazon, and so many others coming out to deny this. It is, at best, sloppy journalism, very, very sloppy journalism by Bloomberg.
Yeah. And I don't think it is sloppy.
See, that's the other thing.
They have all these anonymous sources. I mean, wouldn't you talk to Amazon and Apple ahead of time? Because as soon as it came out, they said, we don't know anything about this. I mean, obviously, yes, okay, let's leave open the possibility of just the worst, shoddiest journalism in the history of journalism. That's one option. But the second one was, this was a hit. This was an operation. And after the fact, people can make a retraction. It doesn't get nearly as much attention as the original headline. And then it comes also at the very moment that Mike Pence, American Vice President, goes on and basically declares war against China. That was Pence's speech last week. And he's accusing China of economic aggression. So it all becomes muddied. It all becomes part of this big picture of sinister China, which, you know, up until a few years ago, the U.S. wanted normal, friendly relations with China. And China was very open about its intentions to modernize and to come out of extreme poverty and extreme underdevelopment. They were saying by the year 2050, they were hoping to be a mid-sized developed country, because even though China has big advanced urban centers and lots of science and lots of industrial activity, it's still a huge country, and there's still immense poverty and backwardness in many parts of the country. Anyway, it seems to me to be part of a political operation against China.
I absolutely agree with that. I don't actually believe this is shoddy journalism. I was trying to give them, you know, a little bit of benefit of the doubt, but this is actually part and parcel of how Bloomberg covers tech stories with an international spin. There have been many stories before, including accusations of Russian hacking of Turkish oil pipelines and others, where they have done a very similar thing. You know, they're anonymous sources and misinterpreting or misquoting their named sources. Bloomberg is effectively serving, you know, their corporate owners and then the interests of the U.S. government here.
John, I want to turn to another part of the story, because a Chinese intelligence official was lured to Belgium, where he was arrested back in April, and now he's been extradited to the United States. John, I want to ask you about this because you were a longtime CIA officer. Here's the New York Times. A Chinese intelligence official was arrested in Belgium and extradited to the United States to face espionage charges, Justice Department officials said yesterday, a major escalation of the Trump administration's effort to crack down on Chinese spying. The extradition on Tuesday of the officer Yan Yun Zhu, a deputy division director in China's main spy agency at the Ministry of State Security, is the first time that a Chinese intelligence official has been brought to the United States to be prosecuted and tried in open court. He was lured to Belgium. This was a sting operation.
This is a dramatic, dramatic development. I can tell you, too, that if the man is a deputy division director in the Chinese Ministry of Security, he's not the one out there recruiting spies. He's not the one in Cincinnati trying to infiltrate General Electric Aviation Division. He's the boss. This is a senior official inside the Ministry of State Security. So for him to be lured to Belgium, apparently by the FBI, and essentially snatched and extradited to the United States, this is a major development. And I have to say that, as if things aren't bad enough with the Chinese, relations with the Chinese right now, this is going to make our relationship dramatically worse.
Yeah, China denies the spying accusation. I'm looking at Global Times, which is not an official organ of the Chinese government or Communist Party, but, you know, reflects their views. U.S. charge, quote, purely fabricated, says foreign ministry spokesman. China denied spying accusations by the U.S. Department of Justice on Thursday after an alleged Chinese intelligence officer was reportedly charged with economic espionage. Now, we don't really know the facts. Like, in all of these things, John, This story is being released to us by the media.
That's right. So and it's 6 months after the fact.
6 months, because he's been in custody since April 1st. The Chinese government, if this is true, though, the Chinese government, it would seem to me, would be forced at some point to retaliate.
Well, I was just going to say exactly the same thing. The Chinese government, even if the guy is guilty or the Chinese are guilty, the Chinese government is going to have to retaliate, because that's how
Some Americans.
They're going to have to arrest some Americans.
I mean, during the old Soviet U.S.
And then
Cold War,
there's a trade,
a swap.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
Another big development in the new Cold War.
I wish we could talk about this for an hour, but we're out of time. We were joined earlier in this segment from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. military has grounded its entire fleet of F-35 fighter jets in the wake of a crash last month in South Carolina. The F-35 has been dogged by cost overruns, poor performance, and engineering problems virtually since its inception. We're joined from Maryland by Pierre Spray. He was a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense and a former defense analyst who is considered to be one of the fathers of the F-16 and A-10 fighter jets. He's also one of the country's foremost critics of the F-35. Welcome back.
Good to be back and good to talk to you.
The pleasure is ours. I want to start with some comments that you've made in the past about the F-35. You've said that the F-35 is unsafe, it's full of bugs, that in a close air support role, it is a poor replacement for the A-10. It flies too fast for pilots to spot targets with their eyes. It lacks maneuverability at low speeds. It lacks the necessary radios. It can't survive small arms fire or anti-aircraft guns. It has poor loiter time. We should have never gotten rid of the F-16, the F-15, and the A-10. So why do we have all these F-35s when we know that they're a wreck?
Well, the fundamental reason is the incredibly flawed and, I should say, corrupted acquisition process that unfortunately is now running acquisition in the Pentagon. And the fundamental problem is very simple, is we let Air Force and Navy and Army and Marine generals go to work for contractors who are building weapons that these generals have had influence over while they were in active duty. And it's gotten so bad that close to 90% of generals involved with air, either with helicopters or Air Force fighters or Marine or Navy fighters, go to work for contractors when they retire. As long as we as a nation permit that to continue, we will never have decent, effective air power. It's impossible when those kind of incentives are operating with that kind of huge money.
Pierre Spray is our guest. Pierre, there's the corruption, let's call it corruption at that level. I mean, because if you have the revolving door and you know, high-ranking military officers know that they're going to retire, they're going to retire with a good pension, they're going to retire at a relatively early age, they're going to go straight into these private corporations that are making tons of money hand over fist with, you know, profit-guaranteed contracts. There will be cost overruns. The U.S. government and specifically American taxpayers will pay for that. There's that level of corruption. And then there's the other level of corruption with this particular technology, the F-35, which is that the contractors have deliberately, it seems, and I think we've talked about this in the past, placed these subcontracts for the aircraft in almost every state in the country. So every congressional office or every U.S. Senate office, they don't want to lose the production that's in their district or in their state. So in other words, it's a form of, well, call it whatever you want. It's a kind of bribe.
Absolutely. It's a way of influencing the Congress to vote in ways that are not in the interest of national defense and not in the interest of the taxpayer. That's exactly what it is. And by the way, the penalty for handing out all those contracts across, you know, 48 of the 50 states is very high. You know, people think of it, well, you know, maybe they steered a contract.
That's an important point.
Yeah. They say, well, maybe they steered the contract to Montana instead of Georgia because the senator from Montana is so powerful. But so what? You know, they're going to build the part. It's pretty much going to cost the same. That's not at all true. The penalty is very, very high. First of all, they're outsourcing far more parts than they should, which makes simply the control of the production very, very difficult. Secondly, when you decide that you want to build a nose wheel in Montana instead of Georgia, you know, there may not be a really qualified contractor in Montana, but you're bound and determined to send a certain amount of money, so you go for a second-rate contractor that's in the right place, right? Now, the second-rate contractor, you know, starts producing your nose wheel, and it's out of spec. He's screwing it up. You can't fire him because you need that senator, right? So effectively, you've lost control over your production process because you've let politics interfere in the selection of of the sources for the parts you need. And of course, you have tremendous schedule problems because you've got contracts all over the place that really should have been in-house. And again, you can't control the schedule very well because you can't fire the contractor that fails to meet the due date, right? So you wind up with a bunch of major quality control problems that, of course, affect, you know, the safety and the maintenance of the airplane. This was so bad in a recent example on the F-22, also built by Lockheed, like the F-35. They actually had something called a shim line, where when they got bad parts in, instead of sending them back to the contractor to get them, you know, built to correct specs, which would take a lot of time, and they were falling far behind on schedule, they would actually have a special assembly line where they would take these somewhat out of spec parts and they would kind of shim them to fit. You know, in other words, we were going back to the primitive kind of hand-built production that people were doing before, you know, before mass production was invented in the 19th century.
Oh,
so we were hand-fitting parts. Now imagine the poor 19-year-old mechanic on the flight line when one of these parts breaks and it's been fitted in there by shims. You know, because they had a contractor that wasn't so hot, right? A subcontractor, I should say. Here's this poor 19-year-old mechanic, and the part broke, and he orders a new part, and it's not quite the same as the part he had. You know, now he has to apply, you know, the kind of expertise and, you know, years of experience that it takes to shim the part into place. You can't expect him to be able to do that. First of all, he didn't even know that the parts aren't identical, you know. So that gives you an idea of the scope of the problem of farming out contracts to 48 states. It affects the lives of the pilots. It affects the maintenance of the airplane. It affects how often you can fly the airplane, you know. And, of course, it tremendously slows down the schedule and adds cost, needless to say, because, you know, no matter where you fix the problem, whether you fix it, you know, on the shim line or send it back, it's going to cost the taxpayer money to fix it.
We're speaking with Pierre Spray. He joins us from Maryland. He was special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and he's a former defense analyst who's considered to be one of the fathers of the F-16 and A-10 fighter jets. Brian, I'm wondering also why a policy decision was made whereby all four branches of the U.S. military had to have exactly the same jet fighter.
Yeah, and I'll toss that back to Pierre, but I want to also just jump in, Pierre. I'm looking at now this, the reason the entire fleet of F-35 fighter jets has been grounded is because of a crash in South Carolina last month. It's the F-35B, which is able to land vertically. That plane costs $100 million. That one copy.
No, it costs far more than that.
Okay, so I'm just getting my news from the mainstream media, so go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, go ahead with what you were saying, but the normally quoted costs are burying all kinds of hidden costs. You know, they're tucked away in other corners of the budget. But beyond the shadow of a doubt, the airplane costs at least $150 million. And if you include all the fixes that are still remain to be done to the airplane to bring it up to original contract specs, it's probably going to come out at over $200 million.
$200 million for a single plane. And they don't have efficacy. They don't actually work in battlefield situations. That's what you've told us before. Tell us why. I mean, are they stealth? Do they have stealth? Why are they inoperable or not worthy from a military point of view?
Well, you have to kind of look at that mission by mission. Remember, this is the do-everything Swiss knife of airplanes, right? It's like a screwdriver and a saw and a hammer all combined in one. And obviously, it doesn't do any of those three very well. Multi-mission airplanes never do. But this airplane was supposed to do close support. You already outlined, very well, why it can't possibly do close support. And it's not only just inferior to the A-10, it's basically hopelessly inferior, incurably inferior to the A-10 at actually supporting troops, you know, getting in close on very dangerous close-in firefights and not killing our own people. That's the problem. When that airplane tries to get in close, which it has to really distinguish friend and from foe, it will get shot to pieces. So it can't do it. And that means it's going to be trying to distinguish friend from foe over imperfect video links and stuff like that from 15 or 20,000 feet, and Americans will die. Americans will die because there'll be, you know, there'll be accidents and guided weapons placed in the wrong place, as we already know has been happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, and mostly in the case of, you know, high-speed, high-altitude bombers and fighters. The A-10 has far less of that problem, both because it can get in close and because the pilots are 100% trained for close support. Remember, a multi-mission airplane carries a multi-mission pilot. So he's got to split his time between close support and deep strike bombing and air-to-air, and he's not going to be that good at any of them, just like the airplane isn't very good at any of them. But just to summarize why it doesn't work in deep strike bombing is, first of all, if you're going to insist on the stealth, and the stealth has added an enormous amount to the cost of the airplane and to the maintenance difficulties. So if you're going to insist on stealth, you basically, right now, the airplanes, the F-35s that are flying can carry two bombs. That's it. You know, I mean, ludicrous payload. Even after they fix some of that, they probably will almost never go out with more than four bombs.
We're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Pierre Spray, who joined us from Maryland. He was a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense and a former defense analyst who is considered to be one of the fathers of the F-16 and A-10 fighter jets. He's also one of the country's foremost critics of the F-35 fighter jet. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
U.S. intelligence services apparently have intercepts of Saudi government communications indicating that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the kidnapping of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who has been missing for more than a week now since entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Turkish officials believe that Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered inside the consulate. The Saudis are denying any wrongdoing. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, I want to ask you a broader question first. It seems to me that this alleged murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a very prominent journalist, is part of a planned out, well thought out plan on the part of the Crown Prince. When he became Crown Prince, overthrowing a cousin who was far more qualified to be a governmental leader than he arrested virtually everybody in the kingdom who might someday pose a threat to him, including the former Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef. Now, they were held at the Ritz-Carlton for a while. They paid fines. Some of them are still being held. Some went into exile. Some have been transferred to a prison. We're talking about senior princes, important people, especially some princes with intelligence service backgrounds. So now there's nobody really to challenge the authority of Mohammed bin Salman inside the kingdom. So what does he do? He launches a war against Yemen. He begins, let's say, kidnapping journalists who have been even just barely critical of his leadership. Are we looking at a tipping point, do you think? Is there anybody in the kingdom who can pose a threat to Mohammed bin Salman? It seems that Saudi government policy is just out of control under this guy. And many other Saudis are saying he's just a kid. He's only, what, 30 or 32 years old. He's a petulant child who knows nothing about running a kingdom.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot of interpretation why this incident happened in Turkey. But the reality is, if you look at the whole history from the time that his father was appointed and he was given power, he has used that power with brutality, with really brute force against even his own family, against any opposition. And then he's gone into war. And now I think is the time for anyone, any sort of dissent. I mean, let us not forget the fact that he didn't have more. I mean, you know, we are talking about this incident, and people are saying that he was an opponent of the Saudis and a critic of the Saudis, but he wasn't. I mean, he actually was a supporter of Saudis, but he really had some criticism against the prince. And this wasn't even tolerated. And we are really seeing an extremely intolerant and very powerful young man with no experience. And, and this is what is really dangerous. And the fact that United States is giving him all the backing, and now he seems to be having a very special relationship with Netanyahu and the Israelis. So he's got that sort of support, and all these supports have gone to his head. So he's now trying to create a fear. And, you know, if you look at other incidents that has happened in the last week, I mean, for example, in London, we had an imam who has been very much supporter of Saudi Arabia. He's been working ever since I remember in a mosque, which is run by the Saudi government in London. And suddenly he was fired, and he was given no time. He was given no proper even sort of sending off. He just received a phone call and said that, you know, you no longer could give sermon here. And then we see other incidents, the way that the Saudi Arabia and their TV stations in London and elsewhere have dealt with the act of terrorism in Iran. And, the fact that other sort of supporters of Saudi Arabia that have been supporting Saudi Arabia for many years have now started seeing that really they need to be critical of the prince, because of what he's doing in Saudi Arabia, what he's doing in Syria, what he's doing in Yemen. I mean, really, there is no way to sort of justify this, even as those who are loyal supporters of the Saudi Arabia. And they see that as a damaging for Saudi Arabia, his behaviors, his maverick behavior. And now he wants to create fear among those who are exile, those who are living in West, those who are living in places like Turkey, and say that, you know, I'm going to be very public and open. I will come and go for you. I mean, you know, they could have taken him out in many, many other circumstances. But to actually sort of do that in the consulate in that way, so is so public and so clearly sort of identifiable that they were behind it, it actually shows that this was deliberately done to create further fear beyond the borders of Saudi Arabia.
Masoud, I'm looking at the New York Times. Interesting sort of back and forth, including with Donald Trump. I want to read it to you. The Saudis will keep killing civilians and journalists as long as we keep arming and assisting them, Senator Paul Rand, Republican of Kentucky, said on Twitter Thursday. The president should immediately halt arms sales and military support to Saudi Arabia. But Mr. Trump quickly made clear he would not. Quote, what good does that do us? Mr. Trump asked, speaking to reporters midday in the Oval Office. I would not be in favor of stopping a country from spending $110 billion, which is an all-time record, and letting Russia have that money and letting China have that money, Mr. Trump said, referring to an arms deal with the Saudis brokered last year that the president has said will lead to new American jobs. Now, first of all, there's not going to be new American jobs because of U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. That's not happening. Well, maybe there will be one. I don't know. But it's not like a big jobs program. I mean, it's a capital-intensive industry. But it's very interesting that Trump puts it so straight away. We must sell weapons to Saudi Arabia to the tune of $110 billion because it's good for America. It's good for American business. It has nothing to do with national security.
Right.
Or security of the region. It's just, he says it exactly as it is. And then he says, we're actually competing with Russia and China to see who's going to sell arms. So from Trump's point of view, no big deal. But there is a lot of congressional voices now, Masoud, against the U.S. connection with the Saudis under these circumstances. Is it just purely reactive to the apparent kidnapping and possible murder? Or is there something else in terms of geostrategic politics and positioning? These same Congress people, they didn't seem to care that much when the Saudis and Mohammed bin Salman were not only ordering the bombings of school buses that killed lots of kids, But Mohammed bin Salman seemed to indicate that that was a good thing. None of that got a rise out of Congress. Is there something else going on?
Well, I unfortunately really don't think this is anything more than seasonal. Now we have seen what has happened in Turkey, and the voices which are sort of articulating and shouting is Turkish government and to some extent Qataris as well, and the infrastructure of Qatar. But, you know, what really puzzles me is that, as you said, you know, arms sales of this nature would only help the 1%. It's not going to help the masses in the United States in any means or shape. And the reality is that, Save the Children Fund only 10 days ago announced that in the current position of war in Yemen, in the next year, 1 million children are going to die. You know, 1 million children. And then we are talking about pounds and pennies or dollars and cents for the U.S. I mean, it's not, as we mentioned, it's not going to go to the masses. And even if it does go to the masses, is this really worth it for humanity to actually do that? And then on top of that, you know, we are... What we haven't discussed is the way that Saudi Arabia is unleashing acts of terrorism and supporting it in Syria, now in Iran, and they're being very upfront and public about it. You know, their TV station, which broadcasts in Farsi, which apparently, according to Guardian, has got a budget of $29 million a year, has, you know, publicly supported the act of terrorism in Iran. And, you know, this sort of creating this sort of havoc in Middle East and beyond and killing that many children. And, you know, let's not even mention the rest of the population which are going to be killed in the next year. I mean, really, this is a huge disaster. I really think that what we are seeing as opposition, be it in United States among politicians or anywhere else or UN, it really hasn't, is not fit for the purpose. We need to stand up against this young man who seems to go completely bonkers and, you know, is being supported for doing these acts. I mean, you know, look, compare what has happened in Istanbul with what Russia has been accused of. And look at the, you know, sort of the consequences of this is an act which, you know, this individual actually went inside their consulate and never came out. It's very clear. We have got evidence of all these special agents arriving into Turkey and then leaving hours later. And then going to the embassy and being involved in this act of either murder or indeed kidnapping.
Yeah.
And the international community has done nothing whatsoever.
No, and this is the dichotomy between what's happening against the Russians, what's happening against the Saudis, or the lack of anything happening against the Saudis. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined from London by Masoud Shajada. Masoud is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Federal court judges are balking at what they call unlawful efforts by U.S. immigration authorities to continue to detain people charged with entering the country unlawfully, even after they had been granted bail. The rulings complicate the Trump administration's so-called zero-tolerance policy against defendants charged with crossing that border. We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barón, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Welcome back, Jorge.
Thank you for having me on again.
Jorge, this is going to be a clash that comes to a head, I think, sooner rather than later. There's already a similar issue at the Supreme Court, and you're involved in it. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, we do things in the immigration detention system that to a lot of people, and including some federal judges, seems really problematic. And so the case that the Supreme Court heard this week, which we have with our partners at the ACLU and other colleagues, is challenging an aspect of this immigration detention system where the government's claiming that they can hold people in so-called mandatory detention without giving them an opportunity to even appear before an immigration judge to ask for bond. This is not to be released immediately, but just to even have a hearing. The government's claiming the authority to not allow that. And so that's, you know, that was already ruled that the administration is going beyond the congressional authority here in Washington and California. It was upheld. That ruling was upheld by the Ninth Circuit, and the government is now going to the Supreme Court to try to get it overturned. So I think it's just a pattern that, you know, particularly under this administration, we're seeing of the government trying to use this power in the immigration detention system to try to hold people without giving them even an opportunity to be heard before a judge. And that's, I think, the reaction that we're seeing from some federal judges is just that, you know, that's not the system that we heard. Justice Breyer, at the oral arguments, said something along the lines of, you know, said, you know, even, you know, triple axe murderers get bail hearings in the criminal justice system. How can you not allow people to have a hearing in immigration, the immigration system? But that's the power that the federal government is claiming.
And we also got a little insight, a little preview into who Brett Kavanaugh is here in his first week as Supreme Court Justice. Talk about what Brett Kavanaugh did at that hearing.
Well, I think we're concerned about that because I think it's something that a lot of us were concerned about in terms of his deference to the power of the executive. And I think he's basically saying, well, you know, this is the, you know, the what the political branches want to do, and we shouldn't be second guessing them. And you know, but that's exactly what the sort of framers of the Constitution envisioned, was that the courts would serve as a check on the power of the executive and the legislative branches. And so we are concerned that by those statements about the direction that he's going. And you know, I do hope that, you know, we saw even Justice Gorsuch expressing concerns about the government's position. So we remain hopeful that the court will ultimately back away from the federal government's claims in that case.
Who would have thought, John, Gorsuch is, I mean, compared to Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
Seemingly like a rational,
which is, I mean, it's insane to me.
It's crazy. It's like the pendulum has shifted so far to the right. But I want to read a little bit from the Washington Post exactly what Jorge is talking about. Judge Kavanaugh said a 1996 federal law required detention even years later without an opportunity for a bail hearing. What was really going through Congress's mind in 1996 was harshness on this topic, he said. This is Kavanaugh. This is our new Supreme Court justice. Gorsuch suggested that mandatory detention of immigrants long after they completed their sentences could be problematic. And Gorsuch is the one who asks, is there any limit on government's power? And Kavanaugh apparently says, actually, no, it doesn't matter. And then, as Jorge said, Stephen Breyer said, so a person 50 years later, 50 years after the, quote, criminal offense, 50 years later, is on his deathbed after stealing some bus transfers 50 years earlier, and he doesn't get a bail hearing. And then, as Jorge mentioned, in this country, even a triple axe murderer is given a bail hearing. It's really, it's quite shocking, Jorge. It's really, really quite shocking.
You know, I have to add something, too, that one of my attorneys told me in my own case, and I think it applies here as well. When I was in the midst of my case, he said, you think this is about justice. It's not about justice. It's about mitigating damage. And I think you can say that about so many different legal issues in this country, and this is one of them.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jorge.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's, I mean, I think in some ways, and I think particularly in the immigration context, I think you see things that you just don't see in any other, you know, legal area. I mean, we're fighting another case here in the Ninth Circuit that deals with the appointment of counsel for children in deportation proceedings, right? And we've been trying to do some research of whether there's any context in any legal system in the United States where children are put through a legal process without, you know, counsel being present or an attorney being present to help them. And there's nothing except the immigration, the deportation system. And so I think the fact that we're seeing this reaction from some of the federal judges that you've alluded to, when you know the Trump administration brings people to federal court and then they try to use the immigration detention system as a way to get around it, is saying like, well, wait a minute, you know, this isn't right, and some of the folks in the judiciary are stepping in, but I'm concerned about the direction that the Supreme Court is going. Of course, and particularly the comments from Justice Kavanaugh yesterday, that there aren't any limits on executive power.
The Federalist Society has been grooming Kavanaugh just for this purpose, because other judges over time, sometimes right-wing judges, they morph to the center, or they sometimes even morph into being somewhat liberal. I think the Federalist Society and their whole legal strategy is to groom people who are political operatives and thus will never, ever move, because they're functioning really not as judges in the traditional sense of the word, but as political operatives. And Kavanaugh right now appears at the court to be just another voice on behalf of the Trump administration. Anyway, I know you're a lawyer and you're arguing in front of the court, Jorge, so maybe you can't speak the same way because you actually have to go in front of these people. But that's the way it seems to me.
Well, I think broadly the concern is that, you know, the idea of our Constitution is that we would have a branch that would be immune from you know, political, you know, power and be able to, you know, be willing to stand up to the executive and legislative branches. And I'm concerned that right now the direction the court is going, I'm not optimistic about that. And I think that should be concerning to all of us.
I saw those headlines, those gut-wrenching headlines and photos of two-year-olds going into court. I mean, literally two-year-olds.
Literally.
And no legal counsel. I mean, what was the position, Jorge, if you could? Did this all start under Trump, or was this also happening during the Obama era?
Well, unfortunately, you know, that case that started during the Obama era, the right to counsel for children case, started even before that. And so we've seen that, unfortunately, some of the policies at the time have continued. The problem now is that, of course, we see increasing harshness and increased detention, so the impact is even broader under the current administration. But I think it is a sad part of the legacy in terms of immigration policy from President Obama, some of the arguments that we made. And, you know, I have to say, I had colleagues who were working in the Justice Department at the time and trying to sort of figure out why they would be defending this kind of policy. But unfortunately, that's what they were doing at the time.
So where do we go next now? This is going to go to the Supreme Court, something, as we said already, like it is already there. In the meantime, do these poor people just languish in a holding cell somewhere? Is there any relief at all that's possible?
Well, you know, we have, I mean, you know, in the case, for example, that was before the court, right now the situation is that, you know, in some parts of the country, because other circuit courts have said that they can, you know, they can be detained in mandatory detention, then they are languishing for a long time. In other parts of the country, like for us in the Ninth Circuit, we've been able to have, because of the rulings here, have the opportunity to have people have bond hearings. But so, you know, the concern is that we'll see what happens with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court earlier this year already in a separate case ruled to take away a good precedent here in our region that would provide people bond hearings if they've been detained for over 6 months. And so some people are definitely being detained longer than they would have before that case. So, I'm concerned that, I mean, that's part of the expansion of immigration detention, is the fact that people are having less opportunities to even get a chance to, you know, contest their detention. And again, we're not talking about, you know, immediate release. We're talking about just the opportunity to even go before an immigration judge and have a bond hearing. So we're concerned about the fact that this is just continuing. And of course, you know, a lot of it is just happening because, you know, Congress is giving ICE more and more money to detain people every day.
Yeah, 6 months before you get, and still no bond hearing.
Yeah, still no bond hearing. And this is one of those things that we've been talking about just between the two of us, Brian, where you've got this executive branch overreach. The executive branch just shunts aside whatever the opinions of the judicial branch are, and you end up with a chaotic policy like this, and people are suffering. But we're going to have to end it there, unfortunately. We were joined from Seattle by Jorge Barón. Jorge is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.